It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up later in the program, we'll be talking about the possibility of a government shutdown and what led to this latest political showdown.
But right now, we're continuing our conversation with Science Friday host Ira Flatow. And you can join us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page and tell us some of your most interesting scientific discoveries, things that have caught your interest, have piqued your attention, and maybe Ira can chime in about some of his. So actually, let's start there. Since you have such a bird's eye view of what's happening in the scientific world, what's some stuff lately that's blown your mind?
I said there's a continuing story that blow my mind about science. One is the continuing story of what the universe is made out of. I mean, here we are in the 21st century, and we think we know a lot about stuff, but we don't know what 96% of the universe is made out of. Everything you can see, all the stuff around the studio, your home, outside, the stars, anything that's visible, is only 4% of the universe. 75% of the universe is made of some strange force. It's dark. It's called a dark energy that was only discovered about 10 years ago or so, when they didn't even know it was there. And then the rest of that is dark matter, which helps hold the universe or galaxies together. We don't know what that's made out of, and we don't know what the dark energy is made out of, but we know what the 4% is made out of. That's just a mind-blowing thing that we have no idea where, you know, what all of the universe is.
And that's where the science fiction writers come in.
Yeah, you know, there are ideas, the whole idea is about quantum mechanics that work, but we don't really understand why. Richard Feynman, who was one of the great minds in quantum mechanics, was very puzzled about this, and he used to have to explain it. And he was one of the best science explainers, and somebody asked him, how does quantum mechanics work? Why does it work? And he says, if any scientist ever tells you why it works, he's lying, because we really don't know why it works. We just know that it really works. So.
Seems like theories about parallel dimensions, string theory, is really hot right now.
Yes.
You know, and we also have rock star physicists like Brian Greene out there. Michio Kaku is another one that people really are fascinated by. I mean, do you think that people are just getting better at understanding science?
Well, I think they're always interested in it. I just think there's a groundswell. Let me give you an example. You brought up a couple of people. There's a groundswell in interest in it now. There's going to be a new version of Cosmos coming out next year, and it's going to star Neil deGrasse Tyson. You know, Neil's a very popular astronomer, and it started with Andrian, who is Carl Sagan's widow, and Neil Tyson talking about possibly bringing this back. And you know who got interested in this and made this possible is Seth MacFarlane.
Really?
You know, is that name familiar to you?
Yeah.
From what?
He's in all those comedies,
gross
out comedies that
yes.
I go to see. In,
yes, Family Guy.
Right.
He does all on Fox, yeah. all these cartoons. Seth MacFarlane said, let's take this to Fox and let's give it real. Let's do this all over again, and we'll get a real audience. It'll be on a major network. We'll promote it in all the other kinds of Fox shows, and we'll just redo it with Neil deGrasse Tyson, who is a perfect person for this. And they're going to, you know, how much more mainstream can science get than this kind of exposure?
That is mainstream.
That's because someone decided that this was the right thing to do and the right time to do it. And there's another example of science being sexy now. Why would Fox, of all the networks, which has all these cartoons and things, want to do something really interesting about science?
I feel like scientists have also been doing a pretty great job lately of articulating the case for wonder, that, you know, you can find it here on Earth in the known cosmos and the unknown cosmos with the dark matter, that there's so much here that is just breathtaking.
It is breathtaking. On the other hand, science is being challenged by people who think that science is just a matter of opinion. You know, there are a whole bunch of conservative people who don't believe in evolution. They don't believe in all different kinds of science. They don't believe in the validity, and will say, well, you know, global warming is just a matter of opinion. This is just a matter of opinion. Evolution is just a matter of opinion, of scientific opinion. And science is challenged by that because the power of the purse strings is locked in Congress. Most of the research, publicly funded research, gets publicly funded through Congress. And if you cut back on those budgets, You know, the sequester now has laid off thousands of scientists who would be working on health problems, who might be working on other discoveries. They're out of jobs while the sequester happens. If we go into shutting down the government, you have all of these other science, you know, the NIH and all these other organizations. I mean, I'm not one to defend all this stuff, but it's just a matter of fact that despite, you know, we all these corporations that do science and technology, most basic science is funded by the government.
Now, you're talking about lots of places that science has shown up in pop culture lately, and we've, you know, talked about how it's in the zeitgeist now, and it's cool, and it's sexy, but how is it doing in the classroom? You know, are kids learning their P's and Q's about science?
It's still in trouble in the classroom. You know, I'm not an educator, and I don't know how to teach science, but I have an idea of how I would change it.
How?
I would teach science. The way we teach it now is we teach it like everybody's going to be a scientist. We teach science, physics, chemistry, as if you're going to be a scientist. And if you don't, too bad, you do something else. But if we don't teach art that way, we teach art like how to appreciate art, right? We don't expect you to be Picasso when you grow up, like we might expect you to be a scientist. But we teach you how to appreciate what he did. We teach you how to appreciate what good art is, how art is done, where to see it, how to appreciate it, how to like it, how to know good from bad. I think that we should be teaching science that way. We should teach you what the role science plays in your life, what makes good science, what inquiry is about, why you need evidence, how to find that evidence, how to put it all together. Maybe you're never going to be a scientist, but you'll be able to know how to think critically. You'll know how to, when you know, stuff comes up, you'll have, be able to look at it like maybe how a scientist does, and to understand and appreciate what science gives you in your everyday life. Because one thing you're going to do when you grow up is you're going to decide whether how science advances. It's going to be your job, whether how you vote or whether you fund universities or whatever. And if you understand and appreciate the role because you learned about it in school and you walk through it, then you'll be a better citizen, I think.
Is anyone listening to you?
I don't know. I don't know if anybody's tried that. Maybe somebody has tried that. Maybe some country has tried that. Because I just think that let's treat science like we treat art appreciation or some other appreciation. Bunch of cuts. Now they don't teach art now anyhow, or music, right? But let's try to teach people to understand what role science and technology plays, what it cannot do.
Well, running out of time here, and I want you to tell us in our last minute or so what you'll be talking about tomorrow as you give your live broadcast.
Well, we're going to talk about genetics and talk about inheriting genes and about my favorite part. And I only have a minute. I'm going to talk to my favorite part. We're going to talk about Les Paul, Wisconsin's own Les Paul.
Oh, we love our Les Paul.
Yes. And we're going to talk with people who knew him. We'll talk about his inventions, what a great inventor he was. Probably the greatest inventor since Michael Faraday or Thomas Edison. He had so many patents. He invented the 8-track recording device technique, you know, that you could make. Well, he changed the music industry. His first guitar that he made was actually made out of a piece of railroad metal. And his mother said, "You can't make it. What cowboy's going to throw a piece of rail over his back and go down in the prairie, you know? Got to make it look a little better," although it played well. And so he said, "I'll put some wings on it." Mm. And he's still.
Yeah, and he was a fascinating guy, wasn't he?
We tried to get him on Science Friday, to talk about it because we thought we might do an oral history of him, but he was just too frail by the time we could get to him.
Well, I'm glad you're drawing attention to his work, though. Such a cool guy, Ira. Thank you so much for being here.
You're welcome.
It's been a blast to talk about this.
You're welcome. Thanks for inviting me.
We've been talking to Science Friday host Ira Flatow. He's speaking tonight at the Wisconsin Institutes for Discovery at 7:00, and he'll be there tomorrow for the live broadcast of Science Friday that's happening at 1:00.
Coming up next, we'll talk about the possibility of a federal government shutdown. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.
A handwritten appeal to the United States Supreme Court asking for the right to counsel ended up sending tremors through the American legal system and gave people who couldn't afford an attorney a shot at justice. Mike Simonson has the last part of our series on the 50th anniversary of Gideon versus Wainwright.
Wendy Doherty of Superior says a courtroom is a pretty scary place, especially when faced with charges of operating a vehicle while intoxicated and 6 months in jail. But Doherty was appointed an attorney from the state public defender's office.
I probably would have gone to jail. I couldn't have represented myself. And for me to try to prove what he proved would have been very difficult. Very, very difficult.
Douglas County Public Defender J. Patrick O'Neill says that's the legacy of Gideon versus Wainwright. In 1961, Clarence Gideon asked for and was denied counsel and then convicted of theft. His appeal led to the ruling that the Constitution gives all people the right to counsel. But O'Neill says having proper defense doesn't translate into being soft on crime. In Wisconsin, 90% of people charged with a crime are convicted.
We are tough on crime. What's important is that we be fair on crime. And that's what Gideon provides.
But O'Neill says the legacy of Gideon is up to the court system.
You have caseloads that are just impossible to meet, that it has become too much of an assembly line law, but absolutely nothing the way it was pre-Gideon. So it has been huge, but it's not yet perfect.
And it's under fire. The Constitution Project's Criminal Justice Policy Counsel, Liz Fossey, says politics can weaken the right to counsel.
As states and the federal government face budget cuts and are cutting back on indigent defense funding, Gideon should remind us that this isn't a budgetary line item. This is a constitutional right that everyone has.
Superior Attorney Toby Markovich says there's also potential for trouble by some public defenders and judges.
It's in the eye of the beholder. Some places do this very cursorily and without their heart in it. But I think most law enforcement agencies now take it seriously. It really makes a difference.
Markovich served as a court-appointed counsel in the 1950s before the Gideon decision. He says an often overlooked Gideon legacy is when an attorney is appointed.
It was even an improvement on what we were doing here in Wisconsin, where people were at least advised of the right to lawyer when they got to court, because it gave them the opportunity to get an attorney early on, when probably the attorney's advice was most valuable to them.
And the case of Wendy Doherty of Superior accused of drunk driving, with the help of public defender Fritz Anderson, she was acquitted.
I cried and I asked Fritz if I could give him a hug. He said, just don't do it in front of the jury. And just tears welled up in my eyes. I mean, I just couldn't believe it. And the jury, the verdict came back fast. 45 minutes, we had a not guilty verdict.
So the Gideon legacy for Doherty is a legacy for many people who can't afford an attorney. The judicial system worked.
It definitely worked. It was fair and impartial, and it was done the way that it should be done, you know?
Wendy Doherty's situation is quite common. The Constitution Project says 80% of people charged with a crime qualify for a court-appointed attorney. Mike Simons in Wisconsin Public Radio in Superior.
And thanks to Mike for that report.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. The threat of a federal government shutdown continues to loom over Washington just days before the scheduled implementation of the Affordable Care Act.
What led to the political standstill, and how seriously should we take the possibility of a shutdown? We'll talk now with Susan Johnson. She's Assistant Dean of the College of Letters and Sciences at UW-Whitewater, a political science professor there. Susan, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Rob.
Well, here we are again. Why do we keep coming back to the brink of shutdowns or debt overloads or you name it?
Dysfunction is the word of the day or the year, I suppose. You're right. We've come back to this over and over again. I mean, at the end of last year, we were facing this same sort of crisis where we had debt ceiling issues, and we had the other kinds of things that were going on. And so it seems like every few months now we have something, and it's just become part of the way Washington operates. It's a terrible way to run a system or a government, but it's become pretty much par for the course.
Is this really a substantial political debate, or is there an element of theater here, or maybe both, I guess?
Is it a substantial political debate? What we're talking about is obviously funding the government and keeping that going and preparing a budget that makes the government continue to operate. There's a lot of theater involved, however. We had Ted Cruz in his 21-hour non-filibuster this week, and we have all this talk about defunding Obamacare as a the only way the Republicans will allow a continuing resolution to go forward to keep the government operating. And just today, the House GOP leadership came out with a whole list of conditions for the debt ceiling debate, which is, you know, reaching that limit is coming up in a couple weeks.
So we've got this double whomper here. It's the how do we continue funding the government past next Tuesday and then the debt ceiling debate. So I've talked to you about this in the past. Somehow they arrive at a deal. We had the sequestration, which involved some cuts that people have found painful, but nothing calamitous yet. Is that going to be the case here? Are we going to muddle through once again?
Well, something has to happen because the fiscal year begins on October 1st. And so if nothing happens, if Congress does not come to some agreement and passes something, then there will be a partial government shutdown. I mean, there's no ifs, ands, or buts about it. The issue is, if there is a shutdown, how long would it go? The issue is, if they come to some resolution, how long would the continuing resolution go for? So even what they're negotiating now is only through the middle of December. So we could be revisiting all of this in just a few short months, even if they pass what they're talking about. But the issue right now has to do with the Republican provision that was added in the House to also defund Obamacare, and that's moved over to the Senate now, and the Senate's going to vote tomorrow to remove that provision, and then the Senate will likely pass a clean continuing resolution, which simply keeps the government operating until December 15th. They'll send that back to the House, and then the ball will be in the House's court, and they will have to make a decision about what they're going to do moving forward.
Well, as you mentioned, the target is the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare. If the shutdown happens next Tuesday, does that delay the Affordable Care Act in any way?
No, not really. The Affordable Care Act, most of it falls under mandatory spending. And if the government shuts down, mandatory spending programs continue. So there would be little impact, honestly, to the Affordable Care Act. In fact, Senator Tom Coburn, back in the summer, asked the Congressional Research Service to put together a policy memo essentially saying what will happen if there is a government shutdown coming forward in the fall. And this nonpartisan bureau put forward a report that said that, in fact, the vast majority of the Affordable Care Act will go forward as scheduled on Tuesday.
So we haven't seen a proper shutdown, I think, since the 90s. What kind of things would happen if not postponing Obamacare?
Well, anything that was considered non-essential would be shut down. So issues like national security, that continues. Anything that's part of mandatory spending, like Social Security Administration, would continue to operate. Other things that fall under that mandatory spending would keep going. And things that are under discretionary spending would not. So quite a bit actually would keep operating even if the government shut down.
Suppose we avoid a shutdown but don't reach a debt ceiling deal by the middle of October. What's the impact of that? Anything similar?
Well, the debt ceiling is a different issue in that what that has to do with is paying our outstanding debt obligations. And that would have wide-ranging impacts on the global economy. And we've been hearing about that every time this debt ceiling issue has come up. And it just happens that they're happening somewhat simultaneously. But there's different potential problems. And frankly, many economists have argued that that's the bigger concern, as opposed to a government shutdown that no one thinks, if it happens, would last very long.
Does it complicate the issue that both these things, the fiscal budget renewal and the debt ceiling debate, are happening so just 2 weeks apart from each other?
Does it complicate things? I think it muddies things is what it does, because these two things have been lumped together as there is similarity because they're both dealing with, you know, with money. But the fact is that they're different things. And when you put them together, it sort of muddies it, and it muddies it for the public. And then it also muddies the ability of both sides, I would say, to negotiate, because even as we're talking about this budget impasse. We have people in the Republican Party, for example, who are telling Speaker Boehner that don't make this the fight, meaning the end of the fiscal year on Monday, but instead move the fight down to 2 weeks from now when the debt ceiling issue comes up. And others are saying, you know, no, hold firm now. So I think that's what it's doing, coming so close together.
We're talking with Susan Johnson. She's Assistant Dean of the College of Letters and Sciences at UW-Whitewater. We're talking about the possibility of a federal government shutdown as soon as next Tuesday. We'll get into the politics behind all of this coming up after the news.
We'll have more with Susan coming up. You're listening to Central Time right here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. The threat of a possible government shutdown looms over Washington at the same time that the Affordable Care Act is scheduled to swing into action.
We're talking about this with Susan Johnson, Assistant Dean of the College of Letters and Sciences at UW-Whitewater. We've talked about the risk of shutdown and what that would entail. Susan, I want to get into the politics behind this, and I'll start with the Republican Party. I'm getting multiple emails a day from national Tea Party-affiliated groups saying, in effect, if you don't go to the brink of shutdown, you are supporting Obamacare, a threat to Republicans of possible primary challenges. Are a lot of Republicans looking over their shoulders on this?
Yeah, I think they are. I think we're seeing that particularly with Republicans who would be considered more moderate than those in the Tea Party. And we're seeing that very notably with someone like Mitch McConnell, who's the current minority leader in the Senate, and he's facing a Tea Party challenge in a primary in Kentucky, and he's been pretty silent on this whole issue as a result of his, you know, the concerns that he's getting from the right. But it's not just Mitch McConnell. It's going on all over the country, this idea of primaries coming at Republicans from the right, and we saw that happen in 2012 as well.
And Mitch McConnell is not somebody who you'd hear the word moderate thrown around a lot for. I think he was viewed as a conservative Republican stalwart by many for years.
Right, absolutely. And that's why I hedged a little bit. I wasn't sure what. I mean, he's very conservative, and he always has been. And I wouldn't, you know, use the term moderate. However, he's been anyone who even breathes a willingness to work with the president or to compromise is now considered a moderate or, you know, not a true Republican.
We've heard, though, from a lot of Republican Party figures in Congress, governors around the country saying it would be irresponsible to have a shutdown happen and it would be bad for the Republican Party. What's somebody like John Boehner, who seems to be along that line but yet faces revolts from within his own party in the U.S. House, how does he juggle all of that?
John Boehner probably has one of the toughest jobs in America right now because he's a negotiator, you know, and you don't get to be speaker unless you're, you know, you're someone who's willing to make a deal and all of that sort of stuff. And so for him, it's a huge challenge because he's got this significant group within his caucus that is quite adamant that there should be no negotiations and quite willing to see the government shut down. And the problem for Boehner is that he's had to go to them more than once and say, just this one time, we're going to move this forward. And there's this thing called the Hastert rule. His name is Dennis Hastert, the former speaker, that something, the majority party should not bring something to the floor unless the majority of the majority supports it. And Boehner is an advocate of this Hastert rule. But three or four times he's had to violate that norm of the Hastert rule, and he's brought things to the floor of the House that have not had the support of the majority of Republicans, and therefore things have passed, like the tax increase that passed at the beginning of the year, that have passed without a supportive majority of Republicans. So it's been some Republicans and a lot of Democrats. And so Boehner's had to go back to his caucus many times and promise this is the last time. And those who said, okay, you said this is the last time too many times, are really digging in their heels now.
Then you've got people in Congress who are talked about as potential presidential candidates, our own Paul Ryan. I've definitely, again, been getting emails from Tea Party groups talking about Ted Cruz as a possible Tea Party candidate for president. Are people looking that far ahead as they approach these negotiations?
Oh, sure. I think that individuals like Ted Cruz, I mean, having his 21-hour speech yesterday, it made me wonder if he was trying to match Rand Paul's filibuster from earlier in the year, because Rand Paul received a lot of notoriety as a result of that, and it kind of made me think they both are thinking about running for president. You know, I wonder if Ted Cruz wanted to do something similar because of that. I don't know that to be the case, but that's kind of what ran through my head. But certainly they're thinking about the presidential election in 2012 and how this might help them gain the Republican nomination.
On the Democratic side, the White House and the Senate majority, they're being asked to compromise by delaying the Affordable Care Act for a year. That doesn't appear likely to happen. Is there any other thing that they might be able to negotiate out on to throw a bone to the Republicans?
Well, I mean, people have thrown out, you know, the idea of a one-year putting, you know, Obamacare implementation off for a year. There's been some other, you know, things related to implementation of the Health Care Act that they've put out there. But, I mean, the fact of the matter is, and people like John McCain on the Republican side are saying this, the law was passed in 2010. It was most of it was upheld by the Supreme Court, and we're already into implementing that law. So the major part of it is kicking in on October 1st, but parts of it have been already in operations for, you know, for over a year. And so it's not as if you can just pull the plug entirely on it. And I think that's something that has to be taken into consideration as well.
From the public's eye, I start off by saying, you know, here we go again. This has been coming up again and again with the debt ceiling or with continuing resolutions to fund the government. Do people care anymore? Is there some sort of shutdown, imminent fatigue going on?
You know, the New York Times released a poll and they asked people, you know, how long have you been following the budget debate in Washington? And 18% said very closely, and then about 40% said somewhat closely. And so about 60% of people said they're following it at least somewhat closely. I don't know how you define somewhat closely, because I get the same sense of shutdown fatigue. I mean, this is it's like the boy who cried wolf, and it's come up. And you alluded to the sequestration cuts earlier when we were talking, and the fact is that when those happened in March, a lot was made of all the horrible things that were going to befall the country if those sequestration cuts were allowed to happen. And there have been significant hits to, you know, certain people. And so by no means has it not hurt people, but the sky did not fall. And the one thing that would have impacted a lot of people, the air traffic issues, those were fixed, you know. And yet everything else is in place, and most people haven't really felt a lot of hurt from that. And so I feel like there is this idea that we've been through this before, and when we've had these potential government shutdowns, it really hasn't happened. And we have to go back almost 20 years to where there actually was a shutdown.
What would it take to get through this era of, you know, going to this cliff, playing these games of chicken again and again?
What would it take to end it?
Yeah. How do you see this changing, and how would it change?
I think the only way I see it changing is if one party or the other has the presidency in both houses of Congress and 60 votes in the Senate. I mean, that's the only way, is one party unified government with big majorities, and then they can kind of do what they want. I don't see us moving towards, I don't know what would move us towards an era of compromise or working together when we've been moving every day further and further away from that.
All right, Susan, thanks a lot for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Sure thing.
That was Susan Johnson, Assistant Dean of the College of Letters and Sciences at UW-Whitewater.
Coming up, is cow tipping really a thing that actual people do, or is it just a myth? We'll find out after we check the latest headlines. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Veronica, you've heard of cow tipping, right?
Of course I've heard of cow tipping. I'm from Wisconsin.
I'm from Michigan. I grew up across the dirt road from cattle, from cows, and the 20, 30 cows. I never heard of cow tipping until I went to college, and all the city folk there promised me, promised me that us rural people spent all our evenings, nights, going out and tipping sleeping cows over.
Well, look, I lived in Campbellsport, Wisconsin for a long time. Not a long time. A couple years. And I heard many a story about cow tipping, and I think it exists.
Okay. Well, our guest
says... We'll see what our guest says.
Yeah, he says it's more myth than reality. Jake Swearingen is with us. He's writer and digital director for Modern Farmer. Jake, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, you write, you looked into this. You think that cow tipping, if it happens, it's super rare. It almost never happens. Make your case.
Sure. You know, I do want to say that I do think that occasionally within the course of human history, a cow has been shoved over by human beings. You know, we're very inventive, creative creatures. We have, you know, built the pyramids. We went to the moon. So if we want to push over a cow, we can. What does not exist is the popular myth that you can, as a drunk young man, and it's always drunk young men doing this, sneak up to a cow that's sleeping on its feet in a pasture and just sort of give it a good hard shove and the cow will topple over. And after looking into this for a while, I firmly believe that that does not happen. Nobody does it on any regular basis, and there's just a whole variety of reasons for that.
Well, let me just say off the bat that I hope cow tipping does not happen a lot because it sounds unpleasant for the cows themselves. But tell us how hard it would be to actually tip a cow over.
Well, a professor at the University of British Columbia, Dr. Margot Lilly, and her student, Tracy Boatler, actually did the physics on it. They ran the numbers. And they made some assumptions that they had to make. They basically assumed that the cow would be unmoving, which wouldn't happen in reality. In reality, a cow would be aware of you as you approached it. But their equation basically said, first of all, one person can't tip over a cow, period. One person can't generate the amount of newtons or the amount of force that you need to get a cow over. Two people could if you have sort of this ideal, optimal state cow, a cow that's unmoving, doesn't brace its feet, doesn't move around at all. In reality, a cow has a lot of things going for it that keep it on its feet, such as, again, it can brace its feet, it will move around. It's not a solid body. It's, you know, there's some push, there's some give to the cow, so not all of the force that you're applying to the cow will go directly to it. Also, cows are taller than human beings, so you're having to lift up a little bit. And so what they found was that really you need about five people at least. And they have to be five pretty strong people, and really six people is about where you start to get into cow tipping territory. And even then, you know, the thing to remember is that part of this myth is that cows sleep standing up, and this just isn't true. Cows sleep on their stomachs. So if you approach a cow that's standing up, it's really aware of you. Cows have been prey for a long time. They have been hunted by predators. Beef has been what's for dinner for thousands and thousands of years. So if you approach a cow, the cow is aware of you. It does not want to be shoved over. It will move away from you very rapidly as you do it. So that's the sort of the physics of it as for why I don't believe it exists. But there's plenty of other reasons as well.
Well, and one of the reasons is you scouted YouTube. And if anybody does anything on this planet, somebody has put it on YouTube. Is there a lot of cow tipping going on there?
There is no cow tipping on YouTube. You know, what you find is if you start searching for it, you'll find lots of videos where somebody claims that it's cow tipping, and then it's somebody actually flicking over a toy cow figurine, or it's somebody, in a really awful case, some college kids came across a dead cow and claimed to have tipped it, and, you know, the cow died, and obviously they just found a dead cow. A lot of what you see is attempted cow tipping videos, which tend to be very... Blair Witch Project-esque forays into a field where you're just a lot of running around and then usually running away from a cow. so it doesn't, you know, like I said, YouTube is I think the line I say is the largest clearinghouse of human stupidity the world has ever known. I believe that's true. If people do something stupid, they will upload it to the internet, and nobody has done this. So nobody has uploaded a video of this. So yet again, I think that that's sort of my one of my other arguments against the idea of cow tipping existing.
Jake, you realize you're just throwing down the gauntlet for anyone within spitting distance of a cow, right?
I do want to emphasize right now that I am not encouraging, and I hope that everybody who is listening in Wisconsin does not think now, okay, this is how I'm going to become famous on YouTube, is shove over a cow. First of all, again, I think cows are actually very gentle, very soulful creatures. They should not be shoved over on their sides. Secondly, it's actually really dangerous. I mean, cows are huge. Even a dairy cow, which is, you know, a mid-sized cow, can come in about 1,500 pounds. So if you try to tip over a cow and you mess it up, there's a really good chance not only are you going to hurt the cow, which is hurting a farmer's private property, but there's a really good chance you're going to hurt yourself as well. And, I mean, and that's not even getting into the idea that a lot of times in fields, there'll also be a bull hanging out, and the bull comes in at about 3,000 pounds and will gladly eat your lunch if you get close to it.
I don't know. I still think you and Rob might be cow tipping denialists. You know, I swear there were people who swore they knew someone who had tipped cows. I'm curious, actually, if you're listening and you know of someone who's actually tipped a cow, better yet, if you yourself have actually tipped a cow, you know, it's not a good thing to do. Cows are soulful. But just for the sake of science, are cows tippable? 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234.
Well, here's a comment from Marcia on Facebook. She writes, "My dad was born in a small rural town in Illinois. He always said he and his cousins tipped cows, and I believed him. I wish he was still around so I could ask him if he was weaving a yarn or telling me the truth." Is that part of why the story? Do you think there's some leg pulling going on here?
Well, I think that there's some leg pulling going on. I think it has, I talked to a professor of folklore about cow tipping for a while, and there's actually, you know, the cow tipping became this sort of cultural phenomenon in the 80s for whatever reason, where it started popping up in a lot of 80s and 90s, where it started popping up in a lot of movies and TV shows. But apparently there's oral histories of cow tipping occurring even as like the earliest 20th century. And I think one of the reasons that it's so popular is that it has the same sort of quality of a good joke in some ways. You know, there's just sort of a Three Stooges-esque, like really like it's a pratfall, you know. It's this big thing falling over. And so it sticks in your head when you hear it and you want to believe it's true. The other part of it is that I think it also like functions as something like a rural snipe hunt. I think that you take a city kid out to the country and you put a couple brews in them and you say, hey, you know what we like to do? We head out into the field and we push over Bessie, go out there. It's a lot of fun. And then you and your friends get to hang out on the fence and listen to somebody slip and slide in a dark field and, try to push over a cow that will be having none of that.
Well, our phone lines instantly filled up when we invited callers. So let's see what Wisconsinites have to say. We've got Dan with us in De Pere. Dan, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. Just wanted to kind of say that it's always seems to me that it's one of those things where everybody says they know somebody who knows somebody, but nobody's ever met anybody that's done it.
Yeah,
nobody is ever the one that says, yeah, I did it. It's always, oh, my cousin did it or my friend did it. I live and work on a dairy farm. I'm actually working right now in a tractor. And I had some friends that came over, you know, in high school trying to do it. And I told them they can't do it. When we have to do it for medical reasons to do surgery on a cow, it takes three of us and a rope and sedation to do it.
Wow.
Oh,
yeah, Dan raises a really good point, which is that when there are times where a cow needs to be put on its side or cow veterinarians do it, and it's called cow casting, and it's a really complicated procedure that takes really highly trained people to do it. And you can't find videos of cow tipping on YouTube, but you actually can find a couple videos of cow casting, which is when they take the cow over on its side, going wrong. And when it goes wrong, it's a very dangerous situation. You have a very angry animal in a very small space that has now been sort of tipped over on its side. I mean, it looks very, very dangerous, which, again, shows how dangerous cow tipping could be.
All right. Thank you to Dan. Let's go to Dave in Madison. Hi, Dave.
Hey, how are you?
Okay, well, what's your story?
Well, I grew up in Ohio, and I came to college one summer, and a bunch of my buddies and I, we went out to this field. And I'm not going to lie, we had quite a bit of alcohol in us. And there was like four of us, and we tried to push the animal over. And it just wouldn't budge. And then finally, the cow got really mad, and he chased us, and I slipped in the poop.
Well, there's a cautionary tale about cow tipping. All right. Well, thank you, Dave. And again, it sounds unsafe.
I would say proof that karma exists in this.
All right. Thank you, Dave. How about Tammy in Adams? Hi, Tammy.
Hi. I actually did witness a cow tipping situation.
Okay.
At my family farm. My dad, we were sorting cattle, and some were going to auction and some were going out to pasture. And my dad had just hung a brand new gate earlier in the day to separate the cows so that we could sort them out. And the cows that were going to pasture were about 800 pounds. And we were trying to get them in the trailer, and one of them blew through the gate that my dad had so proudly hung that day. And my dad was so mad. He's a very large man. He won't admit to his weight, but he's got to be at least 400 pounds. And he got very mad at that cow and grabbed a hold of its horns, and it was a steer, grabbed a hold of its horns and tipped him over. And I thought, there it is. I can't ever say that I've never seen it.
That's an amazing story. And, you know, there actually are videos. And, you know, there are instances where I've heard of farmers being able to successfully wrestle cows down. I would also point out in that story that cow was about 800 pounds, and the sort of numbers that we were working with was a dairy cow, which is about twice that weight, or not quite twice that weight. That said, also a 400-pound man can generate quite a bit more force than I think Dr. Margot Lilly was assuming in her equations. And also just, I guess, tip of the hat to being able to take down an 800-pound cow. I mean, that's just an impressive feat of strength.
Now, Jake, you wrote a follow-up piece. You said no cow tipping, but there is cow flipping done by professionals. Briefly, what is that?
Cow flipping is very real. So cows, again, they don't sleep standing up, and in fact, they spend a lot of time lying down, usually digesting their food. And sometimes cows, for whatever reason, they'll lie down on a hill, and normally they'll lie with their feet facing downwards on the hill, and that's fine. They're able to just sort of pick themselves back up. But every now and then, according to the farmer I talked to, and she had a herd of, I think, about 60 or 70 cattle, there will be a cow that will lay down with its feet facing up the hill. And cows are really top-heavy creatures. There's a lot of bulk up top, and then their legs are actually somewhat spindly. And so if a cow lays on the hill facing upwards, it can't turn itself back over, and it'll actually thrash itself to death trying to get up.
Hmm.
So what farmers will do then is at least two, usually three, will go out and they grab the cow by the ankles and they basically flip her back over. And as long as she hasn't injured herself, she'll get up and walk away like nothing has happened. So, you know, if somebody says that they've been cow flipping, that probably means that they've worked on a dairy farm and that has actually happened.
Not just legend.
If somebody says that they have gone cow tipping, I would say that they are probably feeding you a load of, I think you can fill in the rest.
All right, we'll leave it there. Jake, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
That was Jake Swearingen with Modern Farmer.
Coming up, a look at the life and work of Jim Henson, creator of The Muppets. This is Central Time.